Madoff's formula for success in business.
He joined all of the right clubs. He was in the right settings. He played golf at the right places. He ate lunch at the right places. And he went to dinner with the right people. And what he did was he was able to suck them in.
The investors who got caught in the Madoff sinkhole are counting their pennies this morning. For a lot of people, it's a very low number. Madoff forgot that other rule for success. Don't suck. That's our rule on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, December 16th. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Adora.
Today, we're going to take a look at the automaker bailout plan. Perhaps there are signs of new life on Capitol Hill. The question of who'll get Hillary Clinton's Senate seat is also heating up. And a look at the Securities and Exchange Commission that some say missed many signs of the largest alleged scam on Wall Street. Those stories coming up. First, these headlines.
It's all about the open positions. Today, President-elect Barack Obama is expected to announce that he's chosen Arne Duncan to be his Secretary of Education. Duncan's been heading Chicago public schools for the past 7 years.
And in New York, Governor David Paterson has confirmed that Caroline Kennedy has talked to him about filling Hillary Clinton's soon-to-be vacant Senate seat.
She told me she was interested in the position. She realized that it was not a campaign, but she was talking to other people. She'd like at some point to sit down and tell me what she thinks her qualifications are.
Governor Paterson says he has not chosen a successor yet. In Illinois, it looks like it's going to be a while before Barack Obama's Senate seat gets filled. The Illinois legislature met yesterday. They decided against holding a special election to fill the vacancy, but they did vote unanimously to form a committee to consider impeaching Rod Blagojevich, Illinois Lieutenant Governor Pat Quinn.
If he will not step aside or resign, he must be removed by the General Assembly through impeachment and conviction.
Blagojevich went to work as usual yesterday. He signed 11 bills into law. He has hired legendary defense attorney Ed Jensen.
The Federal Reserve is wrapping up its two-day meeting today. Many economists are predicting the Fed will cut the current rate of 1% in half to just 0.5%. As the Fed gets down to zero, the options narrow for what the Federal Reserve can actually do to stimulate the economy. We'll talk about that later on in the program. Also, investors are waiting for two key numbers to be released later this morning. November's Consumer Price Index, the broadest level of inflation, and housing starts, both are expected to be down again. Oil rose above the $45 a barrel level in Asian trading this morning. It's been bouncing around in the 40s as OPEC prepares for a production cut, which may affect the oil price. The Dow lost 0.75 points yesterday to close at 85.64. The S&P lost more than 2%. It's set to open at 8.68, but all markets are waiting for what the Fed's going to do.
And Barack Obama, we understand, is expected to announce his Secretary of Education today. And that begs the question, what is the advice for the new secretary? What are the biggest problems facing your school or your kids? What do you think the Secretary of Education needs to start fixing on day one? Would like your suggestions.
Get the feds to bail out your school. What do you need? Something simple. Maybe new violins, new stage, new sound system, books, any of the above. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
We have the issue of the auto bailout. My conversations with the White House are that I believe, as I have always believed, that they should use the TARP funding for this and that the legislation we passed establishing TARP gives the White House that latitude to do that.
TARP, Troubled Asset Relief Program, that's Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi yesterday, suggesting that now there is perhaps new signs that the three automakers may get billions of dollars in help from the White House. Last week, Senate Republicans blocked an emergency loan package, but the Bush administration could act unilaterally. Todd Zwillick, reporter for Capital News Connection in Washington, D.C., joins us now. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning.
So the speaker sounds cautiously optimistic, but has anything really changed?
Well, nothing so far, except that there are reports out that the White House could make an announcement as early as tomorrow concerning using the TARP for an auto bailout. Now, whenever anybody says as early as, that means the soonest you'll hear is Wednesday and the latest you'll hear is never. So we'll see what happens. But they are starting to make signals that some emergency aid for the big three is on the way. In fact, in the way that Democrats in Congress said they wanted all along. Remember back a couple of weeks ago, the original fight over this auto bailout was the Democrats in Congress saying, yes, let's give them $34 billion or $25 billion or however that number changed, but let's take it from that TARP account, from that $700 billion we passed to help the failing financial services sector. Treasury, you have that money. Let's use that money. And the White House refused. Well, now the ball's right back in their court, and
it's dodgeball, though. This is dodgeball, Todd. I mean, nobody's actually catching the ball.
I mean, that's the way it works here. Yeah, that's the way it works in Washington. You get this.
Oh, and there goes Todd.
There goes
a dodgeball. We could talk about the rules of dodgeball, in fact. But actually, they've worked out the rules of dodgeball in Washington, D.C. But I think, you know, to reset the bidding here, you know, we started with a bailout that was going to be on the order of, you know, 10, 15, 25 billion that the automakers came, you know, in their planes declaring that they need the money right now and we'll take care of it. Now there's a whole restructuring going on in the auto industry at all levels. And as this is going on, Washington now is taking a look at a much smaller, lower number. So, Todd, they invented dodgeball down in Washington, D.C., right?
Well,
the question is, are the automakers playing or are they just losers here?
Well, they're sort of waiting on the sidelines at this point, because this game is between the Congress and the Treasury and the White House. And there's a chance it could get a little bit sticky here, John, and here's why. So they're talking about using the TARP money, as we know. We don't know how big the White House Treasury package is going to be, but there's only $15 billion left in that TARP account. So if they need more than that, or even something less, what if it's $14 billion? Well, they probably don't want to leave just $1 billion sitting in the TARP account. What if another bank fails and they need a rescue? So here's where it could get sticky. They've spent half of that money. They've spent $350 billion of the $700 billion. In order to get the second half, the Treasury has to apply to Congress for the second
right.
half. And the Democrats in Congress are already saying that Treasury's not going to get it, not under the conditions that they had it before. And why is that? Because they've been very dissatisfied that Paulson has refused to use any of the money to prevent foreclosures, direct aid to homeowners, that there hasn't been enough transparency in how the money's being spent, other things like curbing executive compensation. So what that means is that they're working on legislation now to rewrite some of the rules. They'll get that $350 billion eventually, but they're not going to get it without more strings attached. So,
and when you
Treasury
start talking about new legislation, that would require a vote, right?
That would require a vote. And here's the unknown, the wild card door, is that we don't know when that vote would come. Now, ostensibly, it would come in the new Congress when the 111th Congress is back and everybody's here doing business. However, the automakers need their money quickly, they keep saying. And if this package is to be much bigger, bigger at all than $15 billion, the $15 billion that's left in that account, then the auto bailout and the $350 billion, which is now tied up in a fight between Treasury and the Congress, could get all tangled up together. We don't know how that's going to work now.
So, Todd, last question. Where do things stand this morning when lawmakers head to their offices or they get on the phones? Are they just going to be working on that legislation, or is there still going to be some negotiating going on between, say, Nancy Pelosi and the White House?
Well, both of those things. There is negotiation going on. Now, Speaker Pelosi says she hasn't spoken to the White House in a couple of days, so they may do something unilateral, but they never do anything completely unilaterally, because, again, they're going to have to work with Congress somehow. But that legislation that you mentioned is in the drafting stages right now. Pelosi also said she's working with Barney Frank, chairman of the Financial Services Committee, the man from Massachusetts who's been at the center of this. They're working on that legislation on a separate track. So all of these things are kind of dovetailing into a way that we're not exactly sure how it's going to work out. It could go smoothly. If they happen in two separate tracks, there's a chance. Things could get weird.
So the automakers, still the big three, the big U.S. automakers, still have reason to be hopeful today.
Well, they do, because everybody's everybody is making all the noises that they're going to get some aid money. I think it's unclear how much it will be. It's unclear exactly what the conditions will be. Will it look like sort of the bill that the House passed a week and a half ago with conditions on, you know, what the cars are and with viability plans by March 31st? Will it look like that? Will it look something a little bit different? That's unclear. But they do look like they're going to get their money.
Todd Zwillick, thank you as always. Todd Zwillick.
My pleasure.
From Capital News Connection, reporting from Washington, D.C.
So the vast nation of Russia is caught in its own economic standoff. The price of oil is creating a chilly winter for a government that was rolling in cash just a few months ago. The collapse of oil prices, though, has put on hold billions of dollars in new development of oil and gas and other fuels. It has stalled economic reform in Russia, and it has reversed the Russian government's mission to restore its influence in Europe and around the world. But perhaps the single most explosive element of the Russian predicament is the quality of life for the average Russian. James Rogers covers Russia for our partner, the BBC World Service. And James, the evidence of a declining quality of life for Russians is probably best in evidence in areas that are involved in the oil industry itself. What have you observed?
Well, that's right. I think at the moment, probably people are very nervous about what's to come. I mean, let's think about the way this has gone. In the summertime, we were looking at those prices of $147 a barrel. If you'd asked people then, is oil likely to be close to $200 or $20 by the end of the year? I think most people would have said $200, and most of those people would, of course, have been wrong. So I think people are concerned about what's to come, and we're already seeing that trickling through into the rest of the Russian economy. New Year is the big holiday here in Russia. Travel agents are saying they're getting fewer bookings, restaurants are reporting harder times, and there's a big question mark over just how much people are going to be spending in the shops in the run-up to that New Year holiday.
And part of that confidence problem relates to the cancellation of large industrial projects of various kinds, some in the oil industry, some sort of related to the oil industry, that really were dependent upon 140 and upwards prices of oil. What particular industrial sectors and geographic sectors of Russia have been affected?
Well, you've got to look at the way this country's gone in the last 20 years. There was chronic underinvestment in pretty much everything in the 1990s, the decade immediately following the collapse of communism. That's all been reversed, or at least that reversal has begun in the last decade. So there were a lot of public works projects, building Russia's infrastructure, some very poor roads once you get outside the capital here. That's where that money's going. And for the moment, those projects are still going on. But I think, again, there's a big question mark over them. The Russia had budgeted that next year it would have oil at around $90 a barrel, so it's having to redraw the state budgets to put that at around 50. The oil companies are having to do the same, and that, of course, is affecting their investment into new projects.
Well, give me a sense of a city you visited where projects that were in an aggressive state of spending are suddenly on hold and things are being cancelled.
Well, I went to the city of Perm, which is in the Ural Mountains. It's two time zones from Moscow. It's really on the edge of the oil fields. Beyond there, you get into the Ural Mountains themselves, and then further east into Siberia. And people were saying there that the local government were saying that they are looking again at spending projects. I did visit one project where they were building a bridge. This was going to be a very important road link. Chatting to the workers there, they said, well, we hope the crisis isn't going to affect us. We're going to continue working on this. Other projects, though, they weren't so sure. There are big question marks, just as everybody's having to radically redraw their budgets for 2009.
And in Russia, unlike the United States, where there is a taxpayer revenue source for the government, I mean, when fossil fuels decline like this, it really deprives the government of almost its main source of revenue. I guess in the seconds before we go, a chilly winter in Russia this year, eh?
It certainly looks that way, I think, both for the government and for the private sector. Everyone hoping for better times next year.
All right. James Rogers, BBC correspondent in Moscow, but who has just returned from the edge of the Ural Mountains on the rim of Siberia, where Russian investment is declining in the all-important oil industry. Thank you, James.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. More transition today. Barack Obama is going to announce his Secretary of Education, and we're asking you to give the new secretary some help from the perspective of your own school. What's the biggest problem at your school? What does your school need? Grab the phone out of your parents' hands and call us. Do you think the Secretary of Education needs to do anything in particular on day one? Tell us your stories about what's wrong with the educational system from your school district's perspective and what they need at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Illinois politics have taken a scandalous turn as the governor there pondered who to appoint to Barack Obama's Senate seat. Here in New York, another high-profile story for another reason entirely. Caroline Kennedy, according to reports, has thrown her hat into the ring, expressing interest in the seat Senator Hillary Clinton will vacate when she becomes Secretary of State. But there have been rumors for weeks, yet little movement, and some Democrats have openly questioned her credentials. Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein is with us to give us her take. A complicated candidate, huh?
A very complicated candidate, an extremely private person whose major act in public life, other than endorsing Barack Obama and going to a number of his speeches and rallies, was working to raise money for the New York City public schools. But she was so private that the WNYC local newsroom tried to interview her for a year, and she declined. So now she's about to take another step into public life. She seems to have called every elected official in New York yesterday to express interest in this position, but even the person that she hired to handle her quote-unquote campaign wasn't talking to us.
And after the rumors, I mean, we've been hearing that potentially she would throw her hat in the ring for many weeks now, and yesterday, Governor David Paterson, who will be appointing Clinton's successor, he had this to say about it.
She told me she was interested in the position. She realized that it was not a campaign, but she was talking to other people. She'd like at some point to sit down and tell me what she thinks her qualifications are.
Her qualifications, which some people have said, other than being famous, she really doesn't have any.
Well, what happened is after the initial expression of checking out whether she might be interested, there was a blowback, particularly among some of these members of Congress, people who want the seat themselves or people who've been working in the trenches for a long time.
But isn't there something sexist about that? I mean, nobody ever asked that question about John Jr.
What did
he ever do except wander around with, you know, his gym shorts on and run a magazine into the ground?
You know, New Yorkers like to put their hands on their elected officials. They like to embrace them, maybe box with them. She's been someone that's been at something of a reserve. And a lot of this is coming from, you know, women elected officials or women public policy experts who feel she's been so far in the background that they don't know who she is. Now, Hillary Clinton had the same thing, which she resolved by spending 2 years in New York and having this listening tour and sleeping in people's living rooms and letting them get to know her. This is obviously a very abbreviated schedule, but one of the things that will certainly happen if Caroline Kennedy does indeed become the next U.S. Senator from New York is she is going to have to go out and press the flesh and meet people and become close to people.
She'd need to take a class.
She'd
need probably to take a class in sleeping in other people's living rooms.
I mean, this would be a huge step for her because she has lived her entire life in a very private way, and she'd have to really come out in public and be a very public person in a state that tends to jostle its public officials.
But there certainly are others, as you mentioned, who are interested or whom the governor may be interested in. You want to give us a sense of who those people are?
Right. There's the state attorney general, Andrew Cuomo, who was once married to her cousin, Kerry Kennedy, although they're now divorced. There is Caroline Maloney, who is a candidate that a lot of women's groups have gotten behind. She's a congresswoman from Manhattan and worked particularly on trying to get aid to New York after 9/11.
Long-serving congresswoman, too. Right.
And the other name that's been mentioned, although it's problematic for the Democrats, is a relatively new congresswoman, Kirsten Gillibrand, from the middle and upstate of New York. But she holds a seat in a district that was always held by a Republican who left in scandal and would very likely return to Republicans. And there's clearly a priority on the part of both Governor Patterson, who's running in 2010, and Barack Obama, to have a candidate who can raise millions and millions of dollars and has a big national profile, so that seat won't be a problem for New York.
But Patterson also needs to worry about his upstate votes, and so appointing someone upstate would have its own logic.
It would, although Caroline Kennedy, I think, sort of transcends upstate, downstate, so it does solve that dilemma for Governor Patterson.
And just to be clear, I mean, the governor has the absolute discretion to name the successor.
He does have the absolute discretion, and it's pretty clear to me that the Barack Obama transition team has pulled way back because of the problems that are in Illinois and are going to leave it up to Patterson to make up his mind in this case.
Okay, and I understand we have a listener's thought on the idea of Caroline Kennedy becoming a senator.
You know, if Ms. Kennedy really wants to go into politics, that's fine. She probably has some talents to offer, but why doesn't she start at a local level, or why doesn't she start at a state level? God knows the people up in Albany need some help. But no, just to be handed a U.S. Senate seat on what? Her name. She has no experience, and this is not a throwback to the campaign, but I mean, seriously, meritocracy is being stabbed in this thing.
That's a sentiment that you see a lot on the blogs and that you certainly hear people say here in New York.
Yes, and it's very interesting because on the one hand, New Yorkers really do want someone who's worked for it. On the other hand, New Yorkers want somebody famous. This was the seat that was held by her uncle, Robert Kennedy.
Exactly, and Hillary Clinton was a dynastic candidate in the sense that she was a successor to Bill. So there's a kind of a curious ambiguity in New York about whether you do it for the name, the celebrity, or some sort of
voters.
Voters.
So confused.
Right.
Well, Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein, keep an eye on that, and we'll be hearing from you soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to our listeners, too. That was great.
And now we're going to thank Femi Okeh because she's going to give us the headlines.
And I will thank you very much. Back 28 minutes past the hour. Good morning. The news crossing the wires this morning in Paris. French television is saying that they are getting some police reports about five explosive devices that have been diffused in a large store in the centre of Paris this morning. Now we'll have more on this story as we get some more details. World stock markets have cautiously edged higher ahead of an expected interest rate cut from the Federal Reserve, and the US Central Bank is widely anticipated to slash its current key rate of 1% by at least a half point. A new political party begins work in South Africa today, presenting the governing African National Congress with its first serious opposition challenge since the end of apartheid, and that was 14 years ago. The Congress of the People, or COPE, is made up largely of defectors from the ANC, the African National Congress. State officials say that Mattel will pay $12 million to 39 states to settle an investigation over Chinese-made lead-tainted toys. The company recalled more than 21 million Chinese-made toys last year, fearing the items could harm children. And the human rights group Amnesty International has called for tougher controls on the use of taser stun guns. The taser stun guns actually deliver 50,000 volts of electricity and are used in many countries around the world. That's a look at some news for now.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Today, Barack Obama will announce his nominee for Secretary of Education, and we're asking you to give the new secretary some help.
I'm a teacher myself. The way that the new Secretary of Education can be helpful is to start thinking about how we can measure kids' progress without suffocating them with standardized tests, Gantron sheets, and number two pencils.
What do you think the Secretary of Education needs to be concerned about on day one? What's the biggest problem your kids are facing in your school system? Give us a call with your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
As that listener is alluding to, from the standpoint of teachers, the policy of the Bush administration, No Child Left Behind, is certainly on the minds of teachers all over the United States. Joining us now is Veronica Anderson, editor-in-chief of Catalyst Chicago, a magazine that reports on school reform. Veronica, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let me sketch out a couple of details here. It's expected later today that President-elect Barack Obama will name the seven-year reform-minded school chief of the Chicago Public Schools, Arne Duncan, to be education secretary. The news conference is going to be significant for where it's taking place at the Dodge Renaissance Academy in Chicago. It's one of the schools that Duncan is credited for turning around. Veronica, what do you think the symbolic significance of, first of all, this nominee is in terms of his close relationship with Barack Obama, and in terms of the successes that Arne Duncan has had in the Chicago public school system?
Well, you're certainly right in that the location of this press conference is significant. It's being held at Dodge Elementary School, the prototype of these school turnarounds and what they've called here the Renaissance Schools Movement in Chicago. Dodge Elementary was a school that was not doing well at all, and the district, Arne Duncan, closed the school back in 2002. It was shut down for a year, and then it reopened under new management. An outside organization ran it both as a school and as a teacher training center. And since the school has reopened, the scores have gone up significantly.
Is that,
so it's symbolic in that regard.
Is that the only measure of the success of the school? Because I'm wondering if Barack Obama is trying to signal here that maybe No Child Left Behind is going to be modified in some way under his new administration, or if it's going to be continue with the program business as usual.
It certainly is not the only measure that the school is doing better. And as a matter of fact, if you look at some of the things that Arne Duncan has accomplished as CEO of schools in Chicago, they certainly have gone beyond just the two-dimensional look at test scores and whether they've gone up or down. In Chicago, he has done a lot to expand school choice. In fact, under that Renaissance 2010 program, Arne Duncan has opened 75 new schools, many of them in neighborhoods that have been identified as needing better options. He's also presided over what has become known as a fairly innovative turnaround strategy, where schools were closed down without displacing the children and then reopened within a few months with a new staff, a new academic program, and you've seen a lot of things get better, not just test scores, but the overall school climate, the safety, and communities and parents have been happy with what they've seen.
Veronica, it almost seems as if Arne Duncan is the quintessential Barack Obama nominee, in that this is a man who has really bridged the gap between the raging debate among those who call themselves reformers and those who represent more of the teachers' unions, in that they're wanting more resources. And he seems like someone who really has been able to take bits and pieces from both sides of the debate.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, there have been two schools of thought, as you've mentioned, and I'm sure both sides would call themselves reformers of sorts. But you've got one group that embraces the idea that what happens inside of classrooms is not enough, and that more resources need to be invested in tackling the effects of poverty and how that affects children. The other group believes that it's time to raise the bar of performance for teachers and principals yet again and get those folks to do more. During his seven-year tenure in Chicago, Arne Duncan has certainly dabbled on both sides. I mean, you've seen him implement a pretty expansive after-school program, which paves the way for children in Chicago. Chicago has a very short school day. It paves the way for more learning opportunities for those children. And then on the other side, you've seen bonus pay programs for star teachers, star principals, and administrators. Duncan is sometimes criticized for not having a classroom experience and for, you know, just doing Mayor Daley's bidding. But certainly, President-elect Obama has a defined vision for improving public schools, and Arne Duncan has shown in Chicago he can execute his boss's vision.
Well, quickly then, I mean, the federal government has a kind of a troubled role in the broad national school picture in that it only really supports about 14% of the resources. In a situation where we are having this economic downturn and the schools do need more resources, is the federal government going to be able to come up with the resources that schools need, or is Arne Duncan someone who has a reputation in Chicago of doing more with less?
Well, that's certainly a very good question, because Chicago has dealt with its share of a fairly strapped financial climate for a number of years. In fact, Arne Duncan and others at the school board go downstate every year to Springfield asking for more money, and there's been a fairly long battle here to get some sort of reform.
So he's got experience in those kinds of battles. I guess the two of them met, Arne Duncan and Barack Obama, in the 90s playing pickup basketball games. I guess we're going to find out if he's an outside shooter or somebody who works inside the paint. Veronica, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Veronica Anderson is editor-in-chief of Catalyst Chicago, a school reform magazine, talking about Arne Duncan, who's expected to be nominated for Secretary of Education. Femi Okeh has our headlines.
Hello there. Just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she's talked with a key committee chairman about passing a bill to control the $700 billion financial rescue fund. Pelosi says the aim is to make sure that the $350 billion that is left is used to help out people who are facing mortgage foreclosures. Officials and a witness say that a suspected U.S. missile strike has killed two people in a militant stronghold in Pakistan. The strike in North Waziristan tribal region appears to be the latest in a surge of alleged U.S. missile strikes on Pakistani territory. In Iraq, hundreds are protesting for a second day for the release of a TV journalist who threw his shoes at President Bush over the weekend. An Iraqi official says the journalist has been handed over to the Iraqi military. Hollywood private eye Anthony Pelicano is headed to prison for 15 years. Prosecutors say that Pelicano wiretapped stars like Sylvester Stallone and fished for dirt on celebrities by bribing police to run names through law enforcement
That's
databases.
The end of a huge story in Hollywood.
Which has been going on for a while.
Oh, my God, yes.
And finally, in what's being thought as the very first case of its kind, an Australian lawyer has filed legal documents against a couple via Facebook. The lawyer couldn't contact the pair at the address they'd given, so he tracked them down via the social networking site after they defaulted on a very large loan. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and we're going to turn our attention now to the story about the Iraqi reporter who threw his shoes at President Bush. He's become somewhat of a folk hero. The BBC reports in a 24-hour period, nearly a million people watched the video. Several thousand people have demonstrated in Baghdad and other cities for the shoe hurler's release. For more on the continuing reaction in the Arab world, we're joined now by Mark Sirwa, the managing editor of the Daily Star in Beirut. Good morning, or I should say good evening to you, but thanks very much for joining us, Mark.
My pleasure.
This story has taken on a life of its own. Describe what the reaction has been like.
Well, I think many people are endorsing what amounted to an act of protest against Mr. Bush's policies for the past several years, in Iraq in particular, but across the Middle East in general. Many people feel that they've been disempowered by his actions and his policies. And the gentleman in question, I think, just sort of acted out on impulse.
And we've heard reports that people have been walking around with shoes in their belts in support of him.
Well, you've seen all sorts of manifestations of this. People in Gaza, there are pictures of people painting Bush's name on the bottom of their shoes. In Baghdad, they're pinning their shoes to their protest placards. Here in Beirut, I've seen a couple of guys walking down the street with shoes hanging off their belt. It's just become an instant symbol of protest against American policy.
Mark, in a world where, you know, Tina Fey becomes a giant global megastar for making fun of the Alaska governor during a presidential campaign, how much of this is kind of a function of the YouTube world we live in, or something very particular to the frustration in Iraq?
Well, the shoe is a traditional means of expressing disrespect when used in a particular way in Arab cultures. I mean, even back home, I mean, if somebody rubs a shoe on your face, he's not doing it because he likes you. But here, there's a particular measure. I mean, you're supposed to take off your shoes if you enter a mosque, for instance. So there's a particular measure of disrespect that is communicated by that, that we saw when, for instance, when they tore down statues of Saddam after the invasion in 2003, that people were hitting the statue with their shoe. To have the same kind of symbol used against Mr. Bush, I think, is just a repudiation of what he's been held responsible for here. And I don't think that I don't think a lot of people in the West are aware that there's a very particular brand of humor in the Arab world. That has a bit of irony to it and sarcasm, and it was just taken off like wildfire here.
And how has the media been reporting not only the protest but the reaction to it other than the protests?
Well, the media is like media anywhere else. If there's a story that's not especially hard news, but it appeals to their audience, they're going to go after it. And some of them will even cite their own editorial positions. For instance, there's a television station here in Lebanon that has offered the gentleman a job. And if he accepts, they will pay him retroactively to the moment when he tossed the first shoe at Mr. Bush.
that's interesting.
Love that.
Yeah, no, very strong reaction. Mark Sirwa, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Mark Sirwa is the mayor and managing editor of the Daily Star in Beirut, and he was telling us about the Arab world's reaction to the Iraqi journalist who threw his shoes at President Bush, calling him a dog.
Everyone in Iraq is just two shoes away from a job in Arab media. That's good to know.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, December 16th, and Femi Oke has joined us with the morning's headlines.
Hello there. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. New York Governor David Paterson confirmed yesterday that Caroline Kennedy contacted him about filling Hillary Clinton's soon-to-be vacant Senate seat. He says she'd like to meet to go over her qualifications. This news crossing the wires this morning. In Paris, French television is saying that they're getting some police reports about five explosive devices that have been defused in Printemps. That's a large store in the center of Paris. The explosives were found in the store's restrooms. A new political party begins work in South Africa today. The Congress of the People, or COPE, is made up of mainly defectors from the African National Congress. And they were angry about the ousting of former President Thabo Mbeki. It's the first serious opposition challenge to the ANC since apartheid ended 14 years ago. Colonoscopies are much less accurate than doctors thought. That's according to a new Canadian study published in a medical journal today. Some doctors thought they prevented 90% of cancers, but it's actually closer to 60%. Despite the decrease, researchers say the test is still highly effective and patients should continue to do it. The human rights organisation Amnesty International has called for tougher controls on the use of taser stun guns. Amnesty has released a report saying that it's not a safe option that it's made out to be. Here's Angela Wright from Amnesty.
There are many cases where it appears that the electroshocks either triggered a fatal cardiac arrhythmia or increased the stress levels, causing the individual to collapse.
The taser, which is used by thousands of police forces around the world, including the UK, the United States, Canada and France, delivers a 50,000-volt electric shock to disable a disruptive subject or prisoner. That's a look at some stories making news this morning. John Adora.
Thank you, Femi. So, the Securities Exchange Commission has been part of the debate during this entire financial meltdown. What does the Securities and Exchange Commission do in an era of credit default swaps and other kinds of derivative securities that are much, much different than the traditional stock and bond that the Securities and Exchange Commission are supposed to regulate? Stephen Labaton joins us. He's a reporter for the New York Times who's been looking at regulatory issues as they relate to the $50 billion scandal involving Bernard Madoff, who reportedly last week confessed to a self-described Ponzi scheme, which has bilked investors out of possibly as much as $50 billion. Some investors are feeling that pain this morning, but the feds are trying to count the numbers and figure out exactly what happened here. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
You know, we look at the Securities and Exchange Commission, and, you know, it seems like a completely different planet in 2008 than the SEC was traditionally meant to regulate. Where should the SEC have been in taking a look at Madoff's particular scheme here?
Well, there were lots of warning signs over the years, and there were people who were complaining to the SEC that that Madoff's program looked suspicious, and in effect, the agency did virtually nothing.
And Madoff had two programs. I mean, there was a traditional sort of brokerage, and then there was this Bernie's so-called hedge fund, which was on a different floor of the office building where he had his operations. Does the SEC look at both of those operations the same way or differently?
They look at it differently. The brokerage is supposed to be much more heavily regulated. The investment advisory service is very lightly regulated, although he did register it in September of 2006. And normally, once you register, you're supposed to be inspected within a year, and then every 5 years or so since. But it never was.
Well, is the reason that never happened possibly because Madoff had such a reputation on the street? His brokerage had been around forever. His reputation for success seemed to be absolutely airtight and squeaky clean, and that the SEC possibly looked at him as someone they didn't need to look at.
He did have a very strong reputation, and he also had a blue chip listing of clients. But the resources of the commission are also very thinly stretched in this area, and their budget and number of officials has declined since 2005, and so that's an important part of the story as well.
Stephen, he was investigated by the SEC several times. What happened, say, in 2005 and 2007? Were there any consequences for violations that the SEC found?
There were some very minor technical violations by his broker-dealer, for which he received a modest fine. But the investigators were looking in the wrong place and never followed up on the more serious accusations that are at the core of the stories now.
I guess the question is, where were they looking? Because Bernard, at least according to the reports that we're seeing, Bernard Madoff has told the feds that almost all of the paper that he generated in this financial advisory hedge fund firm of his was completely fake. If they had attempted to verify almost any annual statement, they would have found that it was bogus.
They were looking at his broker-dealer operations and the way in which they executed trades. They weren't looking at the investment advisor and the whole operation on the in the black hole on the 17th floor that he was operating out of the building that they was providing the investment advice.
So that stayed completely under the radar. I guess,
that's,
you know,
right.
On some level, this is an old story. The reason there's an offshore economy is it because onshore there are regulations. The reason there are things like mutual funds is because the regulatory environment for funds and mutual funds that actually dabble in other mutual funds and credit default swaps and all these sorts of exotic securities that have grown up over the last decade or so or even more is because the economy tends to migrate away from an area where the regulatory light is bright and into an area where it's not so bright. Is Madoff any different different than that dynamic that's gone on for years and years?
Well, in that sense, he is not. I mean, a lot. The operation that that looks to be fraudulent was exempted until he registered it in September of 2006 from him registering and facing all those examinations. But that being said, in hindsight now, there were so many telltale signs of problems that that nobody looked at closely, that one looks at this operation and is astounded.
And Stephen, and clearly it's going to be dissected, so much of what he's done over the last years, but it also makes me wonder how many other Madoffs are there out there? If the SEC is not looking in the right place, could it only be with just Madoff's company?
Well, you can expect as a consequence of this that there will be postmortems at the commission, and there will be the next administration, which will be coming in a few weeks with their own new set of regulatory leaders, are going to look very carefully at this case and make recommendations, and I think we'll have no problem if they want it, increasing the staff and the size of the commission, seeking possibly, you know, a new set of regulations on hedge funds. I mean, you may recall that the Bush administration was very opposed, and the leaders of the SEC for many years, to requiring hedge funds to register, although many of them do voluntarily, many of them do not. And this is going to be in the midst of a much bigger debate about overhauling the regulatory architecture.
Finally, Stephen, and quickly, you're an expert on these regulatory issues, and Christopher Cox has not looked well in all of this. He's the head of the SEC. He claims that more resources are needed and more authority is needed. But what is the precedent here? Does the SEC really need explicit authority to look for crooks in areas that are lightly regulated, or can they do it on their own? And is that really the problem here?
That's not the main problem. I mean, clearly, This was a fraud in plain sight, and it could have been detected if somebody was looking in the right place. But it is also true that there is, according to people like Arthur Levitt and others, a deeply demoralized staff at the commission, a very top-down management structure, and one can expect that the next administration is going to look very carefully and probably overhaul the enforcement programs.
Certainly a day one issue for the Obama administration. Stephen Labaton, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Stephen Labaton is a reporter for The New York Times. His piece on the Securities and Exchange Commission and what red flags were missed in the Bernard Madoff scandal is in today's New York Times.
So a lot of work at the SEC and a lot of work at the Department of Education today. Barack Obama will announce his nominee to take that job. And here's some advice for the new secretary.
I have a child in third grade, and what I wanted to say was that accountability needs to be introduced into the education system. Tenure should not be a given. Teachers should really be held accountable and subject to review every year as people in the private sector. If they're not performing, then they should get out.
We want to hear what your thoughts are on the educational system, on your kids' school system, and you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Here's your takeaway.
They'll get that $350 billion eventually, but they're not going to get it without more strings attached.
That's Capital News Connection. Todd Zwillick talking about the auto bailout. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.